Welcome back to the program. It seems that we're always talking about how we've been impacted in some way in our lives by creative destruction. We know that it's widespread and impactful. But in fact, even dictators today have felt the results of that creative destruction. It's much harder and more complex to be a dictator today. Dictatorships have had to become more sophisticated and savvy. Brutal repression has been largely replaced with subtle coercion. But at the same time, the individuals challenging dictatorships have also evolved. And while popular movements may seem like spontaneous and romantic events, they are in reality strategic and organized, sometimes for years before we pay attention. My guest today, journalist William Dobson, has been looking deeply into these issues and argues that ultimately dictators cannot learn to adapt as quickly as the forces allied against them. William Dobson is politics and foreign affairs editor for Slate. He's been an editor at Foreign Affairs, Newsweek International, and Foreign Policy. His articles and essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. It is my honor and pleasure to welcome William Dobson here to talk about his book, The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. William Dobson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. It does seem that we have evolved a whole new breed of dictators that are much more savvy about the world around them and are indeed, with few exceptions, trying to adapt.
That's right. That's right. The modern day dictator understands that the costs of repression have never been higher, that the environment in which they operate, the pressures in which they must navigate, don't allow them to play the same 20th century game that their predecessors played. It's not to say, though, that some don't sometimes opt for violent crackdowns. We see that every day in the headlines coming out of Syria. But that represents a complete and utter failure, because whatever happens in Syria, whether it's a matter of days, weeks, or months, there's no question that Assad's rule is now viewed as completely illegitimate and is just a matter of when, not if. For the modern day dictator, they sort of make sure to avoid those pressures by trying to preempt the moment when people rise up and go to the square. They come up with new successful strategies for tamping down that discontent so as to maintain their one true objective, which is to keep political power in their own hands.
How much of this change can be traced back to the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, it's certainly an important part of it. There's no question, because there are, you know, I think what you're pointing to is there are structural elements here in which their universe has changed. And that is an important part, because what we saw with the collapse of the Soviet Union is that many of these regimes lost their main lifeline to the outside world. This was a key crutch for many authoritarian regimes around the world. And when that was lost, what ushered in was an enormous expansion of democracy around the world, and not just because many of these regimes collapsed, but because in Western countries we saw an enormous cottage industry of democracy-promoting institutions, whether they be NGOs or even government operations, that pushed political pluralism around the globe. And so by 2005, you really saw a high watermark in terms of the expansion of democracy around the world, where there were more than 120 democratic countries around the world, whereas if you went back in time to the early 1970s, that number had stood much, much lower, around about 40. So the story of the last 40 years, in many ways, is an incredibly optimistic one about the expansion of democracy. Now, that's one element. The other elements, of course, and this is something that when I was reporting the book, and I would go to a country, and in every instance, I would meet with people who both served the regime, who served the dictatorship, and those who were trying to upend it. And when I met with, for example, Mubarak's advisors about 9 months before the end, although they had no idea they were at the precipice, they were very candid about the fact that it's harder for them than it once was because of things that they would point to, like the internet, satellite phones, the expansion of networks like Al Jazeera. Information flows are just a fundamental structural change, but the more sophisticated regimes have figured out how to take those pressures and adapt to them. And that's why we see now that there are regimes that are not just surviving, but in some cases thriving. It's not to say that it's not harder, but they have moved, as I say in the book, moved up a learning curve. They've adapted to these pressures.
In Syria, all we have to do is look to the uprising that was crushed by Assad's father to see the way it was done then.
That's right. There was, it's a wonderful sort of parallel, because if you think about Syria and at that moment, you know, Syria 1979, 1980, it's an abusive, repressive country. Then in the period of just 1 month, in the space of February, a low estimate of 25,000 people were killed by Assad's father. Some estimates go up to 40,000. And the key difference is that if you look at Syria in, say, 1983, 84, 85, how is that country really different? It isn't. It was able to commit these abuses, these atrocities, and effectively maintain its place in the international community. That's no longer the case now. And, you know, there are a lot of ways why it's impossible for that to be the case now, because we don't have images, and we didn't certainly in the early 80s have images being beamed out on a regular basis of this ongoing mass humanitarian disaster and atrocity. But now we see that on a daily basis. Assad can ban journalists, as he did very early on in this crisis, but it never had any real effect on our ability to know what was going on there. It's a fundamentally different world.
Certainly technology has played a role. To what extent have the changes in demographics in many of these countries and changes in the economy played a role?
It's an incredibly important point. And it's something, when I was in China doing some of the reporting, for the book, I was meeting with Chinese Communist Party officials, and it was about 10 days after Mubarak had been pushed out of power. And it was an interesting moment because I was, in some cases, talking to Chinese Communist Party officials about the events going on in Egypt, because they were fascinated and fixated on what was going on there. They had a deep desire to understand what these processes were, because it had such direct relevance to their own ability to maintain their own regime. And why I brought this question to them, and as one of their Middle East experts in China put it to me, he said, look, when you have a population where 60% of the population, a majority of the population, is under the age of 30, he said, it's like something that's just floating, and you have no idea which direction it's going to go. And I thought that was a really good way of putting it, there are incredible pressures on these countries where you have a population that is underserved, in some cases even educated, and therefore have far greater expectations of what they want for themselves in their lives, and their anger, their resentment simmers until someone comes along that's able to channel it.
It's also a part of the population that better understands how to use all that technology that is bringing much of this to the world.
Absolutely. That's absolutely the case. I mean, in the case of Egypt, when I was there before the revolution, what really struck me among all the people that I was interviewing as sort of the cross-section of society is that it was the young people in their 20s for the most part, who were the only people who, at that moment in time, say 2010 in Egypt, who were really taking risks and challenging the regime. These were the risk takers. And they were coming up with strategies and tactics and gambits which showed real moxie. And there was no one really left in the society who was doing that. If Mubarak was able to do anything successfully, one of his chief goals and tricks was to maintain a heavy degree of political apathy. Well, he wasn't able to do that forever among the youth, and it cost him.
One of the things that counters all of this is the fact that these youth movements today, these revolutionary movements, are not romantic idealists, that in fact they're very practical people planning very carefully what they're going to do.
That's right. I mean, and it's just the reality of the work itself, in that there may be romantics among their ranks, but they don't last very long. The people that are left to actually engage in these struggles, for the most part, are hardened battle tacticians. And you see this again and again. I mean, I saw this in Russia. I saw this in Malaysia, China, Egypt, Venezuela. These are people who are really students of their work, and you know, in each place I went, I was meeting people who weren't just familiar with the history of nonviolent struggle, thinking back to examples, say, from Poland and the Solidarity Movement, but they were also learning in real time from each other. I mean, what's one of the things that struck me when I was meeting with some of the Egyptian youth was the degree to which they had studied and looked at the example set by the Iranian youth during the Green Movement of just a couple of years earlier in 2009. So a mistake that we often make, and by we, I mean really almost everyone, mm-hmm. is that you look at something like the Green Movement in 2009 and you say, well, the regime is still there, the Green Movement failed, and we write it off as if there was sort of no net benefit or gain at all from this process. And that's not what you'll hear from activists on the ground in many other countries who'll say, you know, no, they didn't achieve their main objective. But I look at what they did and I learned this, this, and this. These were really smart tactics that I was able to examine from what they were doing and then import it and use it in my own struggle. And that adds to a sort of cumulative knowledge, if you will, of what's going on in all these places. I mean, in many cases, because I was writing a book that was about so many different countries, when I would be meeting with Venezuelans or Russians or whoever, they'd say, well, can you introduce me to people in this other country that, you know, because I know you're doing this reporting, can you make a connection? Because I'm fascinated by what's going on in Moscow, but I don't know anyone there yet. So it's really it's incredibly different atmosphere, and again, it's something that the regimes have to deal with now that they before never had to deal with in the same way.
And one of the ways that the regimes are dealing with it is by trying to control everything, but not trying to control everything, and realizing that one, they have to get feedback, and two, they have to allow some steam to be let off.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it's a very important point, which is that you have to have a little bit, from the point of view of the regimes, they have to have a somewhat softer, I mean, the ones that are really most successful are able to allow for a certain amount of dissent to occur. And they can do this through a variety of ways. For example, although they'll control almost all forms of media, they won't control all of them because they understand that there is some value in having a limited free press where there are certain publication or outlets, particularly those that are not online, where people can vent their frustrations. That's fundamentally useful. It's useful because people are able to get something off their chest, but it's also useful as a source of information for the regime. So there's a practical value to it. Or they will allow for elections, of course. They almost all do, because there is some value in having your election be contested. In the Soviet Union, they had elections, and Brezhnev would win with 99%. Well, today, these regimes understand there's really no value in trying to have a staged election where you win by 99%, because everyone knows that it's fraudulent. It's much better to win an election that appears to be contested. So today's modern dictator usually wins with 70% of the vote. 70% is very much the new 99.
One of the other things that's going on is that the planning for many of these movements is going on years in advance of what we actually see happening, and that we're not paying attention to what comes before.
That's right. I mean, and this is a problem, you know, not just in academia with regional experts believing that sort of what they've always seen is what always will be, but it's also true of the media. It's also true of, frankly, of the government, the U.S. government and other governments in terms of their ability to assess the possibility for change. And to do so, you really have to get to know these movements and get a sense of their leadership structure, whether or not they have new and innovative ideas, whether or not they're able to learn from their mistakes, because that's really what we're talking about here, is that the reason that people weren't giving much credence to the Egyptian youth movements is because they hadn't actually ever toppled the regime. So, but for what, you know, that's sort of, and it's sort of like saying, if you haven't hit a Grand Slam home run in the World Series, then you're not a good baseball player. There's a lot one can achieve and do and learn up to that moment that is ultimately the decisive one. And we generally hold them to a standard that's, it's bizarrely unrealistic. So to take today, right now, if I were looking around the world at places where you'd seen a great deal of failure, but there's learning going on, it would be a place like Sudan, where you have a youth movement that's there, that's quite sophisticated, that is learning, that is challenging regime, that's becoming weaker. And I think that, you know, people are really not alive to the possibility that this is a country where you could see dramatic change being led by its youth. And it shouldn't, when if it does happen in a year or two or 4 years from now, it really shouldn't be a total surprise, because there is really smart, innovative work being done by people who are in the trenches and are, you know, much younger than myself.
And you talk about Venezuela as having one of the most sophisticated movements.
Well, the youth, the Venezuelan youth are some of the smartest people I've ever met, to be quite frank. I mean, they have, the Venezuelan student movement there has a higher approval rating than the Catholic Church in Venezuela. They're really considered one of the most, upstanding, segments of society in Venezuela. In part, it's because they approached the work of challenging Chavez in a way that was really quite different. And only, it was only a movement led by the students in Venezuela that was ever successful in defeating, Chavez in one of his electoral gambits. And they did so from the very beginning, to understand that they had a key advantage that no one else in Venezuelan society had, which is that they weren't politicians. Many of them had been 10, 11, 12, 13 years old when Chavez had first come into power. So all the mistakes, all the blunders and corruption that had beset that regime before Chavez couldn't be blamed on them. Their inexperience, and this is something that's true again and again of youth movements, is their inexperience is actually an enormous asset, because when it comes to trying to sway a population to see things your way, it's very powerful to say, you know what? I'm not a part of this system. I am not responsible for those things that happened 10 or 20 years ago. And they were able to use that and then also come up with rhetorical strategies that they never would engage in sort of the war of words with Chavez. They wouldn't even use his name. They would talk about the government, not him. That showed a level of sophistication that, frankly, the political opposition parties in Venezuela hadn't shown.
Given all that we've been talking about, what's happened then since 2005 that has seemingly slowed all of this change?
Well, the regimes have become even more sophisticated. They have grown in their own ability to adapt. And you see this. So if you would say, okay, where do we not see this? You know, the examples would be, we would cite Libya, we'd cite Syria, we'd cite Egypt, which was really caught unaware by surprise by the events that began in Tunisia. Okay, so that's a small sample. But the forces that came with the Arab Spring were forces that ricocheted around the world. So what we should be also looking at is how, say, a government in Malaysia, China, Russia, Venezuela, and many more adapted. And they did so by almost right away, by understanding that they didn't need to come out and condemn these movements, but rather to come out and almost appear to welcome them. They would, you know, Putin came out very early, after initially using strong language, but then coming out and saying, you know what, if these protests against my government are some way a byproduct of the system that we've created here, I'm proud of you. And it's a very confusing thing for the people in the street, because they begin to think, well, maybe we're accomplishing some of our goals. In a place like Jordan, they responded by immediately amending the constitution in a variety of ways so as to appear to accommodate people. And there are some accommodations that are made, but at the end of the day, nothing that really challenges the central chokehold of the regime's hold on power. In the case of Saudi Arabia, it's less sophisticated, to be frank, I mean, because essentially they're just using massive subsidies in order to quell dissent. Some places don't have the meta set of that, places like Jordan, which doesn't have nearly the energy resources, so they have to use political strategies. In the case of China, they've moved very aggressively to make sure that movements that could come out of civil society and the NGO sector never really get off the ground. When I was there, there were many people that I was hoping to interview who I wasn't able to interview because they were very quickly put under house arrest. The government has done an excellent job of keeping tabs on these people and not allowing them to organize in a systemic way. So through a variety of ways, you can see really a backlash against democracy promotion beginning in roughly 2005, but accelerating all the way up to the present. And that's why many of these regimes persevere. I do think that they're ultimately fundamentally flawed, but their goal is to be here tomorrow. And so far, they've done a good job of that.
Talk about Russia, where Putin has been incredibly successful, it seems, in trying to stay one step ahead.
That's right. I mean, you know, in many ways, there was an interesting moment where, at the end of his second term, when the question was whether or not he would take a third term as the president of Russia, which would have required changing the constitution. Hosni Mubarak was visiting Moscow, was asked by the Russian press, what do you think, should Vladimir stay or should he go? And Hosni, you know, here's a guy who stayed in power for 30 years. He said, well, of course he should stay. Change the constitution, let him stay. Russia needs him. Vladimir Putin was much smarter than that. He would not have taken what he knew was bad advice from someone like Hosni Mubarak. What did he do? Instead, he put in someone in power, Dmitry Medvedev, who could serve this role of allowing him to stay true to the constitution and at the same time really be the person who behind the scenes was controlling everything so that he could return to power for a third presidential term, but do so in a way that didn't require doing any violence to the Russian constitution or Russian law. Again and again, you see in the case of Russia, he's been very successful at creating mock institutions that sort of shore up the weaknesses that any centralized authoritarian system have. For example, he didn't want to have a raucous legislature that could challenge his executive control. That's not something that was going to be helpful for him trying to centralize power in his own hands. So the Duma, the Russian parliament, was quickly made into a rubber stamp body. But having done that, he also understood that he was losing something, because there is a role that legislatures play. They are closer to the people than you are as a president or a prime minister. They give you valuable information and feedback on whether or not proposed laws are useful or not. So he created a new body, a separate organization that would allow him to, he could fill with experts who are experts on media, law, even civil society, and they could advise his rule on whether or not these ideas were good. They could be even very openly critical. This way he gets the information he needs that he's losing by making the legislature a rubber stamp body, but at the same time he has an advisory group there that essentially gives him that information but can't challenge him politically. It's a way to sort of shore up your weaknesses and reduce your margin for error. And this is the sort of architecture of a modern authoritarian regime, which makes them far more sophisticated than, say, a Libya, which was essentially just, you know, a police state, essentially. Mm-hmm. They understand that doesn't work nearly as well. There are too many weaknesses, too many possibilities for surprise, and that repression is just ultimately very, very, very expensive.
How much of a difference has it made with respect to expense that there seems to be more money available in the world today to support many of these protest movements?
It does matter. I mean, I think what matters probably more, though, than the amount of money that's available to support these protest movements is how much less money they require. So if you think about it, in just the period of a decade, if you go back to, say, 2000, when Serbian youth were organizing against Milosevic, they needed money. They needed money because if they were going to get their message out, they needed to put together posters, pamphlets, literature that they could pass out. They needed money for stickers, spray paint. You know, it's not enormous sums of money, but it's still money. And for an underfunded youth movement like that, it's significant. Well, it just takes a very short period of time where all of a sudden many of those costs have evaporated for a youth movement, because now what they really need is to, you know, enough money to pay for an hour in an internet cafe. I mean, I've talked to some of the leaders of the Serbian student movement, and they say themselves, gosh, you know, we wish we could have worked in an environment like that. I mean, we had to raise money for our effort. And kids today, look what they're able to do with just, you know, a couple dollars. So it's true that there are groups out there that will help try and fund these efforts. But I think it's you know, as a structural matter, it's even more important that they just don't even really need that much money to get going in the first place.
How did this game of this global game of kind of cat and mouse, what does it morph to next, and how does it play out over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, I think that what you'll find is that there'll be more. There are more and more, if you will, case studies from which, you know, the aspiring activists in Saudi Arabia or Yemen or elsewhere can draw from. There's that. So right away, there's there's more for them to a body of knowledge, if you will, expertise to draw from. That's one of the things that I think people don't appreciate enough from when they're evaluating whether or not the Arab Spring was successful or not. Oh, there's a great deal from the point of view of activists that made it a success, even in those places where we haven't seen democracy spring forward. But we shouldn't underestimate these regimes themselves. I mean, they will continue to innovate as well. One of the reasons I think that the tide is turning in many ways in a progressive direction is that some of these regimes are now, they're becoming more repressive than they were before. And that's certainly the case of, say, Russia or Putin's style of ruling now. He's becoming more and more regressive in his rule the longer he stays, in part because it's harder to maintain those same strategies after the people have seen them for so long. They become jaded and cynical and begin to see him for what he truly is, and that makes the task of renewing his legitimacy as the leader of the Russian Federation harder and harder to do. I think that's something that if he were still in power, Mubarak would probably tell him today.
And, of course, they all can look to North Korea to mourn for the way it used to be.
Well, that's right. I mean, and that's a really good example. I mean, because no leader looks at North Korea and says, that's what I want to be. But then again, it's a different question if you were to ask them if it was between being in power or not, would you opt for that? I mean, I think that's one of the things, one of the most extraordinary stories right now is the events that we see going on in Burma. I mean, there's a regime that all of a sudden is as if they almost flipped a switch and said, okay, we get it, we're going to start to open up. I don't think that it's because all of a sudden the Burmese junta became advocates of Jeffersonian democracy. I think rather what's much more likely is they looked at the Arab Spring, they looked at the way that these regimes are being challenged, and then they looked around their own neighborhood and they saw the examples from China, Vietnam, and others, which are maintaining their control but doing so with much more open societies. And whether it's hubris or desperation, they said, we need to do the same because we don't want to be North Korea, and we need to move up the dictator's learning curve too.
William Dobson, his book is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. It's just out in paperback from Anchor Books. Bill, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.